Welcome to Series 2, Episode 6 of 2 from 2 Cubed. This week, we were joined by the fabulous Rachel Horton-Smith from Health Watch Essex. We had an incredibly in-depth conversation with Rachel about how she became the lead for communications in Afghanistan for Task Force Helmand. We spoke about how she won Communicator of the Year at the Gloss Business Awards and how now working for a charity, why she feels comms is so vital. Without further ado, let's jump straight into this week's episode of 2 from 2 Cubed. We are literally just going to jump straight into it with the first question that we ask everybody, which is, who are you?
I am Rachel Horton-Smith. I don't know what else you want to know about me.
This is the thing. Every time we ask it, everyone's like, what else do you want?
Well, you feel like you should say, I'm the comms lead at Health Watch Essex. And then I think, oh, is that how I define myself? I'm a bit more than that.
Yeah, that's good. But Health Watch Essex. So yeah, what is your role within Health Watch Essex?
So I lead on all communications and marketing for Health Watch Essex, which means everything externally and internally that has any communication element I'm responsible for. And I do work with a colleague, Kat, who supports and helps with all of that as well. And gets involved in lots of the delivery. So,
okay, brilliant. So, who are Health Watch Essex and what? So, yeah, give us sort of an understanding as to who they are, what they do.
So, Health Watch Essex is an independent charity, but it was set up under the 2012 Health and Social Care Act, which essentially said that it was really important that patient voice was included in the design and the delivery of health and social care services. And so, what we do at Health Watch Essex is ensure that that is represented in kind of every level of health and social care. So, that can be anything from reviewing literature or getting involved in conversations or meetings or just people sharing their stories with us. Yeah. Because a lot of what we do is we then end up looking at trends that exist. Mm-hmm. And then that helps to inform the research and engagement that we do. So if you look at the charity as a whole, it's split into engagement and research and information and signposting. And so essentially the engagement and research teams are out soliciting stories, finding out what people think about particular topics and doing academic research to help inform the services about how they might best improve or the things that might be a good idea from a patient perspective that perhaps the most senior people in the organisation haven't thought about.
Yep.
And then the information signposting team exists to take phone calls or emails or WhatsApps or any way that you can think of contacting us to help people navigate the health and social care system in Essex, because it's pretty complicated and very often people call us with very complex cases, where people need to access lots of different types of services all for the same individual.
Yeah.
And there's no one obvious place to go to. Health Watch Essex is a good place to go to for that.
So actually, when it comes to comms and marketing, your role is quite important, because basically all of the work that Health Watch Essex do is about, communicating
and engaging.
And engaging with
absolutely
an audience.
Yeah. I mean, communication is the heart of everyone's role in Health Watch Essex, which is nice, because sometimes communications gets a bit segregated as that's what those guys in the corner do,
rather than
it's everyone's role. Whereas in Health Watch, I think we all recognize that it is everyone's role, and you have to be a good communicator to do this type of job. Any of the services actually in Health Watch need to be decent communicators.
So how do you communicate within marketing, and how do you communicate to your audience with marketing?
So we've got loads of different ways. I mean, one of the reasons I love working at Health Watch is because it always struck me as a really creative, innovative team. So I've worked in quite structured environments before where there's a lot of risk aversion, and Health Watch Essex doesn't have that. So we work really hard to do new things all the time and to see what works through trial and error and try to reach people in different ways. So we have all the traditional mechanisms of flyers and leaflets and the things you would expect us to have. But then we're always trying to develop new ways of communicating with people. So we've launched our Instagram account this year.
Okay.
And that was a very deliberate attempt to reach younger audiences because we find that we tend to have a slightly older demographic that engages with us.
Well, that's normally what they say, isn't it, about health, is that young people don't pay too much attention to it because they don't have many health issues. Yeah. It's actually older people that pay more. So how do you then engage youngsters into health?
And it's funny because actually I think that's a bit of a misnomer. It is true that as you get older, sometimes you rely on certain services, but... for example, we released a report just last week, which was about young people in a secure mental health unit in Essex and their experiences. And we'd had a researcher embedded in there for 6 months. Right, it was a really amazing opportunity to just see what it's like from their perspective. And one of the findings was that those young people wait too long in order to be referred to those services, and they reach crisis by the time they do. That's often down to who is the very first person that they speak to, and does that person know what to do? Do they recognize this cry for help as that, or do they think, oh, well, don't worry about it, you'll be fine? And young people then think the same thing themselves. So they think, oh, well, this is fine, I don't need to access a service. I don't need to be medicalized. And then eventually do end up medicalized, but in a much more extreme situation.
And that's why sort of mental health, unfortunately, is sort of booming at the moment, is because people, young people especially, are being told, oh, you'll get over it, it's nothing major, you'll get over it. So they are sort of taking that back step, and then, as you've sort of just said, is it is that it's getting then to crisis point, and then they're going, oh, I actually do need some help now. And then what the sort of problem is because that demand is so high, they're at crisis point, but they're not actually getting access to that support for 6-12 weeks.
Absolutely.
And that makes such a huge impact. So it's quite interesting to hear that you are sort of utilizing Instagram. What in particular are you using on Instagram, like the platform?
So we tend to use it a lot for imagery because a lot of young people tend to, that it's the world of immediate access to things, isn't it? Yeah. So you just flick through things really rapidly. Younger people do that for everything, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Think about dating apps. It's just a quick flick through and it's a yes or no, isn't it? It's instantaneous. Yeah. So Instagram's a bit like that, isn't it? Because things flash up and they're just in your face very rapidly. You get a sense of who we are and what we do and whether we might be able to support you or help you with things.
Yep.
We use it at a lot of events so that it shows where we are and what it is that we're doing. Okay. So that, because we tended to go out and do a lot of events before. Our information and signposting team are always at outreach events, because that's also a really important part of marketing, is having face-to-face conversations with people, word of mouth, all of that remains. It's kind of a blended approach to have effective marketing. It has to, and particularly with Health Watch Essex, because I was just explaining this to someone the other day. If you're working for a single issue charity, which tends to work with a particular demographic, I think you can afford to have a really, really bespoke and direct marketing strategy. But Health Watch Essex doesn't have any part of society that it doesn't work with.
It's so
geographically
broad,
based, but it is not demographically based, and therefore we have to be prepared to keep our options open with everything. That means, for example, we're looking at doing an easy read version of our annual report so that people with learning disabilities are able to see who we are and what we do. We do a lot of stuff with the blind veterans in Essex. And so we're looking at creating some of the flyers in Braille. Like, we're constantly looking for new ways of engaging and making sure that we're as accessible as possible. Yeah. And not everyone has that demand placed on them. Yeah. So it's quite a challenge for quite a small charity.
Yeah, definitely. So do you, on Instagram, do you utilize the stories feature?
Yes, sometimes. So we actually need to run some social media training within the organization, because what we're asking people to do, and this is very often what happens, is that people pick up a social media channel for the first time just by playing around with it. That's fine. It's not a bad way to learn if there's an interest in doing it. But then that kind of splits the organization with those who know how to do it and those who actually just find it really daunting because it's not their thing.
Yeah.
And so to make it as accessible to everybody, we're going to try and roll out some social media training. And then I've always believed that people should have choice, and not everybody believes this, but people should have choice about whether they use social media or not.
We agree, which is strange, but we agree as well.
Because actually, if you force somebody who you think, oh well, their role would really, it would make a big difference to the content that's on there if their role did this, if they don't want to do it, there's no personality or character in anything and that they put on there.
And also you sort of run the risk of them then focusing more on putting content on Instagram than actually on doing what they're meant to be doing.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That's it. Yeah. So I don't think that works. I find that out when I was working in policing, we were trying to encourage police officers to become, I mean, this was a decade ago, so they've moved on leaps and bounds since then. Yeah. But it was sort of seen as something that we played around with in the comms department, but that nobody really could gauge the value of. Yeah. And then, of course, it became such a big thing because it became an investigative tool and police yeah. officers needed to learn how to use it.
On Twitter, yeah. you see police officer after police officer now.
Oh, yes. Oh yeah. yeah, all individually tweeting about, you know, who they've arrested. Well, not mm-hmm. who's
shown what they person. Found, yeah. who, yeah.
yeah.
All the arrests they've made today and all that yeah. sort of stuff.
And I think, you know, there's slightly more risk for them involved in some of that yeah, because of definitely. The legalities. So they need to be well trained. But I think when you explain what something does and the value of it to someone and you give them the opportunity to learn how to use it and it's not their thing, you should allow them to step away from
yeah,
it
and
let,
other, no.
let,
yeah.
let others step up who really yeah. do want to do it.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's going to be part of what we do this year is roll out some social media yeah. training.
No, that's good. So sort of backtracking a little bit, we'd love to understand a little bit more about your experience, how you got into comms and things like that. So tell us how you became the lead for communications in Afghanistan.
This could take up the whole podcast. It's such a circuitous route. So this goes back years and years and years, but I'll tell you the story anyway, just okay. because it kind of was the pivotal moment where I decided I wanted to work in some way in news and communications. So, you might be able to tell from my accent, I grew up in Northern Ireland and it was around the time of the Troubles and I wanted to be a lawyer. That's what I wanted to do. So I was dead set on that. But my mum was head of careers in our school. And at that time we had an initiative which allowed, it was a cross-community initiative, which provided work placements to people from both sides of the divide in places where it was difficult to get work experience. And this opportunity came up at ITV. And my mum said, why don't you go and do this? It'd be great. And I said, no, I want to be a lawyer. It's a waste of a week. I'm not doing it. Yeah. I'm going to go and spend time with a solicitor, a barrister. And she said, but we know people who do that. Go and do this for a week. I think she'll always regret that decision because I went, okay, begrudgingly. And off I went. And I had a very exhilarating week with the ITV news team, but it was in Belfast. So we were running around after bomb scares.
I was about to say, but that was quite exciting.
There were phone calls coming into the newsroom and... we were rushing, as everyone was rushing away from things, we were rushing towards them to see what was happening. And there was nothing glamorous about it. It was a real life example. You wait kind of 3 or 4 hours for a controlled explosion to be carried out while hiding behind a wall in the rain and someone bringing you sausage rolls from the local bakery. You know, it wasn't exactly glamorous, but I just loved it. And I came home and I said, oh, I want to be a journalist. That's what I want to do. And I don't think my mum could believe that I had done a 360
yeah,
turn.
On your career, yeah.
I still went ahead and trained as a lawyer, but I never worked as one. I went straight into working in communications and journalism. But quite quickly, I ended up going and working for Greater Manchester Police because they were a big organisation and I wanted a bit of extra journalism training. And I figured that they would have the development opportunities that I wanted.
Yeah.
And I just loved that. I had such a lot of fun there. And I actually thought, well, maybe I want to be a police officer. This is so interesting.
Okay.
So I'd done it for a couple of years and I thought, well, the only way I'll know is maybe if I leave and go and do comms somewhere else. And then I'll know whether it's policing I miss or whether it's the comms aspect.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up going to the military because it seemed like a pretty easy step across, but it was a different content. I would be doing something that was different. And I worked, so I was based in the West Midlands and responsible for communications for all of the units that were based in the West Midlands and wherever they went, I would go and cover stories, etc.
Okay.
And a big part of that role was promoting what they did and then also promoting what they do at home because they have to come home and integrate back into communities. And a lot of that community, if it's a big unit in quite a small town, that's a big part of their community.
Yeah.
And so there was quite a lot of work that went on around sort of communication and engagement with local communities about what the military do. And then they were looking for someone to go out to Afghanistan to run the media communications center in Lashkar Gah, which is the capital of Helmand. And I volunteered, which again, I think everybody thought was crazy.
I was about to say, was that an easy decision to make? But apparently so.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so my hero growing up was always Kate Adey. I wanted to be like her. Yeah. After that experience ITV, I thought I'd love to be like she is. You know, it's so exciting to travel to all those countries and see all of those things. So, and I remember speaking to a colleague of mine at the time, and he said, I think you'll only regret it if you don't do it.
Yeah.
And he'd served in Bosnia and Kosovo doing, he was actually a photographer. Right. And he said to me, I think you'll regret it if you don't. And so I went off to do it, much to my mum and dad's disappointment and horror. And it was every bit the experience that I thought it would be. But it, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it was quite dangerous actually.
Yeah. So what was that experience like? What did you actually do whilst you were there?
So, my responsibility was, there was lots of things that we did. So I would brief the commander of Task Force Helmand on anything that was coming from the Ministry of Defence or from any of the agencies, actually, based in Kabul, and then prepare him for any of his media engagements.
Right.
We together, because there was a group of us, but I was the only civilian. So there were other service people there. And they would do all sorts of different types of roles. But my role primarily consisted of running the embed program for journalists. So when journalists were coming out, greeting them, looking after them, running all the VIP visits, so prime ministers and royalty, etc. And I also used to write quite a few obituaries for soldiers and then collate, because there would always be a statement from the Secretary of State as well. So kind of putting those together. And then our job overarchingly was to tell the story of what was going on.
Yeah.
So we had to make sure that where we embedded journalists was capturing the whole story as well as what we were able to say as well. So we had a combat camera team that would go out and they would record things.
Yeah.
You don't think about it, but actually what the Ministry of Defence are looking for is a blend of different types of recording of a conflict, because those will eventually go into an archive and they will be the recording of what happened
history.
In that war.
Yeah, exactly.
So they want novelists there, they want war artists, they want journalists, they want a mixture of people who are able to tell the true story of what happened.
What really happened, which is, it's crazy to think that actually, you know, comms is vital to sort of capturing the history of what was happening there.
I mean, so it's almost 10 years to the day that I was out there, because there was an awful moment where 8 soldiers were killed in 24 hours. You might remember them coming back through Wootton Bassett. It was very iconic pictures of these 8 hearses, and that's always remembered as just an awful day. And you wouldn't believe what that does to soldiers who are out there, because they still see that. They're still able to notice what's happening, and of course for any insurgents, they would think that was an enormous victory. And so that could easily impact on morale, and so our job is to also to try to encourage people to continue with what it is that they're doing and not be hit.
To sort of control it,
A very important and high-pressure job then. So what skills were put to the test in that role? So whilst doing that, what skills of yours were put to the test?
Bravery. I wasn't always very brave.
I can understand that. Yeah.
When rockets are flying around, I'm not used to it. Of course, I'm not trained for it. So if you are a soldier, not that it makes it any easier necessarily, but it is what you're trained to do.
Yeah, you've had some preparation.
And you're armed. And, you know, this is what you have come to expect will be your role out there. Whereas my job was never to be anything to do with any of that.
No.
But you will get caught in it occasionally. And so, I think managing stress levels, being able to see the bigger picture, I think, as well, because you can get drawn down into the weeds of one particular issue and forget about everything else. So so at one point there was an enormous story about us not having enough helicopters. That was all over the news at home. And then, of course, if anybody died on foot in Afghanistan, people were asking questions about, did they die because there were no helicopters?
Yeah.
And I can't ever remember a time where they did. They were actually on foot because they were engaging with the community. Because don't forget, we were in Afghanistan at the invitation of the Afghan government. Yeah. We were there to support and help with peacekeeping and to drive insurgents out. So it was never a war against the people. No. It was a counterinsurgency.
That is the wicked power of the media, though. They twist their stories to make it sound worse than it really is sometimes.
It's so it was always battling against some of that, and you could die in a ditch over some of those things, or you could just accept that some of those stories will go out, they will be inaccurate, and you will have to work with other journalists to try to get the true story out and give them something that's as interesting but is factually correct. I think there was a big challenge working with the Afghan media, because they're on the ground and they know the area, but they had very low levels of skill at being able to relay a story, and they don't have the same journalistic, I'm not saying that's true now, but back then journalistically we had all sorts of guidelines internationally about what you could and couldn't do, and particularly in the UK, codes of ethics, etc., and they're not subject to any of that, and I've never seen any of those type of documents before. So they're doing their best to tell the story as they see it on the ground, but actually a lot of it was conjecture, and it was what the Taliban were telling them, and the Taliban could tell things very quickly because they very often weren't correct. And one thing that I learned that is so important is you must always, always tell the truth, no matter how unpalatable. You can say it in 100 different ways, and you can soften it and you can harden it depending on the words you use, but you must always tell the truth. Sometimes it takes a long time to find out the truth over stretched lines of communication, and so it can be quite frustrating to hear inaccurate stuff reported because somebody wants to win a PR goal,
But it saves you a lot of hassle down the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because obviously if it is found out that you're not telling the truth, it all of a sudden becomes a different kind of PR nightmare, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you lose trust then. I always find that if you... having good rapport with journalists always seemed very important, because my experience of journalists is always that if you're honest and upfront and you try to facilitate things as best you can, journalists are not difficult people to work with. It's when you become difficult or confrontational or evasive that you start to find yourself in difficulties. That's why they call it managing the media, because it is about engaging with them. It's not about running away from it. No. The worst thing you can possibly do is stick your head in the sand and say no comment.
Yeah, exactly. Because then they'll make an even worse story than what is actually the truth.
Yeah.
They'll make that even worse because, you're not willing to talk about it.
Yeah, and somebody else will be. Yeah. You know, you think that you're the only person that can talk on any specific issue. If you walk out there right now and you see something happen in the street, there'll be several other eyewitnesses. If you don't tell the story, somebody else will. Particularly in this day and age of citizen journalism with people...
Of social media, because it's everybody tells a story.
Yeah.
And everybody tells a very different story most of the time.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because back then, social media was not such a big problem. And our worst concern was really about people taking photographs of military equipment and then posting it on Facebook in a way that insurgents would be able to see what we had and operational security, etc. So all of the photographs that went out of theatre were monitored and were checked to make sure that they didn't compromise anything operationally. But nowadays, I suspect that would be even more difficult to do because of the proliferation.
I think there's been a couple of things recently where a couple of images have been leaked and things like that, and it's not been good news. Yeah. How do you manage that sometimes? Yeah. Like, that is not an impossible to manage sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do some training with some of the soldiers, and before they'd go out there, you would give a little bit of input, because at the time there were still a few who were on Twitter, and of course geotagging will show exactly where you are.
Yeah.
If you tweet that, you know, a rocket just missed you by 15 meters or whatever.
They're
going to move it and do it again 15 meters closer.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So even just things like that, that I think because social media was so new and the idea that we were in this developing country that didn't have access to these things, it wasn't right. They absolutely did, you know? Journalists were on there, insurgents were on there. The idea that so generally speaking, you should always consider any social media output as a broadcast to the world.
You're in a bit of a weird gap, aren't you, I guess, because you went from that traditional media to then digital media.
Yeah.
You was bang in the middle of that, really, weren't you?
Yeah, and actually, if you think about, they talk about digital natives and digital immigrants.
Yep.
And I suppose I'm a digital immigrant because I didn't grow up with social media. So social media came around whenever I was kind of in my late teens, early 20s, sort of mm-hmm. around university age. Yeah. So you still have to learn at that point, yeah. don't you? Whereas yeah. you see these little ones running around today yeah. on their iPads yeah. and they're tiny, you know? Yeah.
and I think the scariest thing is just how effectively and efficiently they use them as well.
Yeah.
And you just think that is...
yeah, it's mind-blowing.
It blows my mind.
It's funny though, because those are transferable skills too, yeah. because I've heard that when you first go into certain careers, obviously coordination is a very important part mm-hmm. of, you know, fighter pilots yeah. and learning to drive. I've seen that some of the kids in our village, they learn really quickly because they play all these games that require
yeah.
that require a lot of coordination.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
they're learning a skill that's transferable. Whether
it's just
they,
a terrible skill to have, isn't it? Spending hours scrolling Twitter.
Depends who you ask, I suppose.
Well, yeah,
yeah,
that's true. So how did you, what was next after you sort of finished in Afghanistan and came back? What was the next step in your career?
I became head of communications at Gloucestershire Police.
Okay.
Was that immediately afterwards?
Immediately afterwards, yeah. I went from one to the other, which was lovely because I went from being in Lashkargar and Helmand to having a little cottage in the Cotswolds.
It was like, that is a bit of a jump, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a huge jump. So that was a great job. That was running the communications team in Gloucestershire. And so that was across everything. So it was social media, online, press office, marketing, and the print room, because they still had quite a substantial print facility there. So yeah, I did that for a little while, which was interesting. It was back to where I'd sort of come full circle, yeah. just in a more senior role, because I'd started off in Greater Manchester Police and
yeah.
then
back to the police again.
Back
so
to the police.
How did that lead to you winning an award then?
Oh, so when the riots broke out in 2011 in London, yep. they spread to a couple of different places. One was London, one was Liverpool, and one was Gloucester. And there was always a debate about whether there was a riot in Gloucester or not, because right. technically you have to have 12 people acting in concert for okay. there to be a riot.
We had the same down here. I think we had a couple, Basden, and it happened, Saffron, and people were going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Calm down, five people doesn't contribute yeah. as a riot.
Well, it makes a difference, because if you looked at it on the streets, you'd have said that's a riot.
Yeah.
But where all of those people acting in concert, you couldn't be sure.
Right.
And it makes a difference for the purposes of insurance.
Yes. Yeah.
So if your property has been damaged as a result of a riot, it's usually different in some way than if
yeah.
it's just yeah. damaged because of criminal activity.
Yeah.
So I think there was quite a strong move to call it a riot for certain yeah, purposes.
Right. Yeah,
imagine, yeah. But nevertheless, there was definitely significant unrest in Gloucester. And then after that, we'd never really had to do this before in Gloucestershire, because you know, it's a bit of a patchwork area. There is massive wealth there. There's also areas of reasonable deprivation as well. So it's yeah. a real mixture. And it's not that there isn't crime, but that type of outbreak of violence hadn't really been seen there in quite a long time, or certainly during my time there. And so we launched a campaign called Operation Scorpion, which saw more police on the streets. And it was designed to be a zero tolerance approach, which was quite a hard nosed approach for a place like Gloucestershire, because yeah. it's not a metropolitan area in that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we did all sorts of random things. And the one that sticks in my mind was that we stenciled onto the pavements where people had been arrested as a reminder to people not to break out into violence on a night out, because yeah. if you stood on the spot where someone was arrested just before, then yeah. you're going to think twice, because there are cameras watching and there yeah. are police watching you. So the whole idea was to crack down on small, low-level violence that could potentially spiral out of control.
Escalate.
Because
okay.
it was a little bit of a hotbed after what had happened.
Yeah.
And there were all sorts of strands to that campaign, but that was yeah. the campaign that we were nominated for at the Business Awards.
So how did you market that, I suppose? Now that sounds like a strange word to use, but it kind of is.
Well,
like, how did you market that?
A lot of that was through the media and through online. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So given the nature of the age of the group of people that we were seeking to speak to, the most important mechanism would have been online.
Yep.
However, for us, it was quite good that it was promoted across, because the county itself wanted to know something was being done,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So even if you weren't actively involved in it, the marketing of it in newspapers let people know that we were taking it seriously, yep. and that we were cracking down on it and that we wouldn't stand for that type of behaviour in the future.
Giving a strong message, yeah, that yeah. you yeah, were doing something, as you say.
Exactly. So, we actually did some stuff with kids where we opened the cells, because we had a police station which was... The cells had been shut down. They were kind of an overflow facility if we right. ran out of space in other yeah. cells. And they had a courtroom just to, on top of them. And so we got a judge to come in the spare time. And a lot of these kids had early run-ins with the law.
Right.
And they were brought in with their parents' permission. They were arrested. They were processed through a cell. They were put in a cell for sort of 5 to 10 minutes. They yeah. spoke to a social worker in there and a police officer. Then they went up into the court. You know, the judge spoke to them about what had happened, yeah. what they'd been doing, and what kind of sentence they could expect if they were doing that as an adult.
Yeah.
And then they were sent on their way. And and it was quite a, you know, that was quite a positive way of trying to reinforce to people, you have a choice at this point. And then there'll come a point where you don't get that choice anymore. Mm-hmm. So yeah. we're trying to encourage you to make the right choice and see what the implications of your decision are at quite a young age.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it'd be lovely to know what happened to those kids. I don't yeah. know if any of them did go in the right direction.
Well, hopefully.
Hopefully. We had a bit of fun with them calling the cells in the city centre Hotel Scorpion, and we did some flyers for that, which was about, did you want to stay in Hotel Scorpion, and yeah. And the number of stars it would get on TripAdvisor and all that sort okay. of fun.
I think that's quite a fresh way to approach something that is generally speaking not necessarily looked at in a light way, if you yeah. know what I mean.
I mean, it's also about producing content that's popular.
Yeah.
And that got shared and shared and yeah, shared because people thought it was funny.
Yeah,
and then as
exactly.
a result of that, when other people see it, they then, when it hits the right people's eyes, they see it as funny, but then they also think, I don't really want to stay there for the night.
That is the thing with marketing, though. And if you get it right, most of the time, you're going to achieve the best results if you take a risk with your messaging.
Yeah.
Like there was a campaign in Essex recently about littering. What did it say? Don't be a tosser, it was.
Oh, yeah.
And I know that that campaign was very quickly quashed because a lot of people didn't like it. But
yeah.
I thought that's a unique way of sort of grabbing people's attention, saying that there's, well, I think it's a £75 fine or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But it's just those sort of smart campaigns that do things that, yeah, sort of...
A little different.
Yeah, different and sort of
and
use
I think
comedy
that's,
or...
I think, you know, in the public sector and in the charity world, I think sometimes there can be a concern about those because
yep.
you're asking for public money for something
yeah.
and then you're spending it in this way. And what if you offend people?
Yep.
And so naturally you have to think about that on some level.
Mm-hmm.
But the times where we've been able to be really creative and it has been successful is when, because the organisations that I've been working in have been quite traditionally hierarchical, policing and military.
Yep.
And so actually the buck stops with the most senior person. If
yep.
you've got an innovative leader who's prepared to take
some risks, yeah.
then you can get things across the line. And I was fortunate in all of my roles actually to have worked with people who have been prepared to take some risks around communications. And fortunately, and I want to touch wood when I say this, but they've always paid off because we've taken calculated risks.
Yeah.
We've never said or done anything that's so outrageous
yeah.
that it would be reasonably, you know, it would be possible for us to believe that everybody would be offended by
yeah,
it. We just
yeah.
wouldn't do that.
It's rule 101, though, isn't it? Is don't put anything out there that you may have to take down later.
Exactly.
Because you won't be able to. It's
no.
going to be there.
Yeah. Once it's out there in the ether, yeah. that's it. And,
yep.
you know, I've had to try to get things taken off social media before
it's
when, you know, something's been put up there which names somebody who's believed to have done something. And we might believe that too in the police, but
yeah.
it doesn't mean that their photograph should be up there because they have the right to a fair trial before
mm-hmm.
That happens.
And
so
it happens quite a lot, that as well. That is a
yeah.
prime example, that, because, I mean, been a member of a couple of community groups on Facebook, Tom knows, that make me chuckle sometimes. The amount of times, obviously being social media aware, the amount of times I've had to tell people to take things off.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you're going to be the one that ends up in court, not the person that you're accusing of being being a perpetrator or whatever.
Yeah,
So you do see that quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't imagine that's easy to get rid of.
I always, and you know, with police officers in particular, we expect higher standards of behaviour from them. So I always used to say that to them, like, you don't behave as though you're just with your mates, because on social media you're not. And there are things that even just liking a joke that seems
risky.
Offensive. Are you endorsing that? Yeah. Did you find it funny? If you are, is that offensive to the people that it takes the mickey out of?
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to be so careful. So there's a balance, isn't there? I think if you get too weighed down with all of that, you can't have fun with marketing. And the best marketing is fun.
Yeah.
It has an element of levity about it, doesn't
it? It's fun and common sense, isn't it? I think
in
a fair dose, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, definitely. So, as well as all of that, you also ran your own company for a time?
Yeah, I still have my own company.
Okay.
So Spellbound Communications I set up when I left Gloucestershire Police. And that was really because I wanted to branch out and do lots of different things. My husband wanted to join the police after being in the army for 24 years.
Right.
And Essex were the only place in the country recruiting, which is the whole reason why I'm in Essex.
You're here now.
Because we have no connections to Essex other than that, but we are firmly settled here and we won't move now. But I decided to set up my own business, and that way I was flexible and could move anywhere. And during that time, I had been on the executive board of the police and we had a consultant brought in to work with us on interpersonal dynamics. So how do boards work? Why do people behave the way they do? What works well? What doesn't? How can you change some of the behaviours that stop you from being able to achieve the things that you most want to? And I just find it really fascinating because it sort of gave names and structures to things that I did intuitively just as a communicator. I thought, wow, there's this framework that sits underneath it that explains everything. This is fascinating. So I went off and trained in that. And then I worked for that company as a partner, as well as running my company for a few years.
Okay, cool.
And that
loads of free time then.
Loads of free time.
Loads of free time.
Tons of it. That was lovely. And that was just very different because it wasn't really your traditional communications work. It was more coaching and interpersonal work. And it's all still in the realm of how to communicate effectively, but just a different type.
Do you feel that's come a long way since the time you've sort of been a communicator, if you like? The dynamic of the communicator, do you think that has changed over time? Or do you think it has, even in this digital age, do you think it's still the same?
Well, I think the kind of stuff that we were doing was about how people engage around a table face to face. Although it could be applied to social media, but generally speaking, it was about interpersonal communication. So, you know, when you have a conversation with someone and you walk away and think, oh, I didn't deal with that the best way I possibly could have done, or that riled me a bit, or why did I get upset about that? Or where you become quiet and you just don't engage in a meeting, or, you know, looking at team dynamics and why those are the way they are. And every team has unique dynamics. Everyone is different, and sometimes it serves them really well, and more often than not it doesn't. On some level there are winners and losers. Some people really thrive in the environment they're in, and other people are struggling with it. And so it was about helping people to create tolerance. And so if you understand all the different types of people that there are using this methodology, it can be helpful in traditional communications, because you can think about all the ways that people think when you're planning your communications, because we have a tendency to only think through our own.
Yeah.
I think about the things that I would like.
Yeah.
But I have to also consider all the other people who behave differently to me and who would like different things. And so it's been helpful in producing communication
campaigns. That's key to comms, isn't it?
Yeah. That's something that we have found with sort of a number of our clients, is that they come up and they have a brilliant idea for a video. And then we say to them, but why do you want to make this? What benefit is it going to bring to your audience? And they go, we just kind of really wanted to do it because we like the idea of it. It's like, yeah, but where's the value there? No. What value is that going to bring? Because at the end of the day, this video is not just for you.
Yeah.
It is for engaging with your audience. And if it's only for you, then they're not going to care about it.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
It's something that a lot of people don't really consider. So it's quite interesting.
It is very... as human beings, we're very self-centered, so it's very hard to switch from me to you.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to get yourself in. I mean, when we first started off, we were guilty of doing that. When it came to marketing, it'd be a lot about us.
Yeah.
And actually, people don't care about you.
No.
They care about what you're going to do for them or what you can do for them. Yeah,
yeah,
is it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
So what transferable skills have you sort of acquired through your prolific career in marketing? And why are those skills that you've sort of learned, so you've touched on a couple of them, but why are they so important now to the role that you're in at Health Watch?
Well, because I think because Health Watch pulls everything together, really, because you have to be able to market to absolutely every demographic in every possible way. And actually, do you know, one of the challenges of working, because, you know, I've worked in some really big organisations and Health Watch Essex would be one of the smallest that I've worked in. Mm-hmm. There's a challenge associated with that, too, because you have less resources available to you. Mm-hmm. And so you have to think really carefully about where you place your resources and where you direct them so that they have the greatest impact. You're spending public money, so you have to be prepared to answer for the things that you choose to do and what impact it has. I think it's kind of a unique organization, and it allows me to be really creative. I think I'm probably less risk averse than I was at the beginning. Because I think when you start off, you worry about what could go wrong. And as time goes on, when you really carefully think things through, 9 times out of 10, it doesn't go wrong. And the one time that it does, it is never the disaster that you think it's going to be.
No, it's never as bad.
It's always possible to manage when something goes wrong. So I suppose I don't think so much about the possibility of failure as such, because I don't see it as black and white as that. There are some things which are more successful than others, but there's rarely something that is completely irretrievable.
Yeah.
I don't know. Lots of transferable skills, I think.
So, working for a charity now, why do you think that communications is so important for charities in specific? Because a lot of charities don't have, as you mentioned, the resource to focus on it. They don't understand the importance of communications and marketing. So why do you think that it is so important and that charities should focus on it?
Well, I mean, the lifeblood of a charity has to be communication, because I can't think of a charity that doesn't on some level either need funds in order for it to be, you know, successful financially, or a charity that doesn't need to communicate its message to the public, because all charities have a cause in some way.
Exactly.
And so you need people to understand what your cause is and why they would want to get behind it. Yep. And then there are all sorts of things that flow from people getting behind you. You know, it could be that you have more volunteers. It could be that you then have more resource available to you. We don't fundraise, but if you're a charity that does have a fundraising element, that there's that whole aspect of it. So it's just core, isn't it? Without being able to effectively say what it is that you do to the people that you most want to hear it, what is the point in having the charity in the first place? And so to me, it would seem absolutely core to have it. And I really understand that there are charities that don't have the resource to do it. And I think one of the most challenging things for them is if you don't have the expertise, how do you get the expertise to just upskill some of the people who are not communicators normally, but to do some of this stuff on a basic level? Because even if you can do a little bit of it and know where,
something's better than nothing,
just know where to devote your time and attention to. And that's where I think actually social media is really beneficial, because it is possible for anybody just tomorrow to sign up to a social media site and then to begin to cascade messages through it.
Yeah, and build an audience.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, that maybe it might feel a bit daunting to some charities if they don't have any communications resources. Where do you start? You know, if I set up a channel, does it mean that I'm going to spend a lot of time manning it? All that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you feel like you just want to give an hour of your time to give a bit of direction so that they can then go off and running knowing confidently that they're using their resources in the best way.
Yeah, doing it the right way, definitely. So what key marketing methods have Health Watch Essex used that you've seen the sort of best return on investment from?
I think social media always works well for us, just because we can hit lots and lots of different audiences through different channels, and because there are awareness days for almost every conceivable condition that you could imagine. And as a result, we're then able through hashtags to draw together people who don't know about us and connect nationally. So those sorts of things work quite well for us, although they're not great for profile raising necessarily because everybody else is talking about the same thing on the same day. So if used in the right way, those awareness days can work quite well. The face-to-face stuff is still so important for us because we're about sharing stories and about finding out people's experience, and you can't always do that from behind a screen. So getting out and about and talking to people, having people know who we are and having people use our services and experience something good means that people come back to us and share that with other people. So we did a novel patient bed roadshow last year where we took a patient bed out across Essex. It always starts from a slightly ridiculous place and gets moderated over time. So it started off with us pushing a patient bed around Essex. I can only imagine the number of roads we would have had to close, and I'm not sure. I think it might have been a PR own goal. So in the end, we ended up taking a bed to lots of different locations. And that was great because it was just a chance for people to see like a really bright branded bed that people could sit on, have a chat with us, tell us about their experience. And we took it to hospitals, we took it to leisure centres, shopping centres, into community centres. And we learned a lot from that, actually. We learned where people will share their stories with you, what type of stories they'll share in a public space and what they won't. Some people only wanted to give us their number and get us to call them back. We learned that actually people in hospitals don't want to talk to you at all generally because they're in a stressful situation and they're waiting for an appointment or they're visiting somebody who's not well. And therefore, the idea of being involved in some theatre, which ours was a bit of theatre, it probably doesn't appeal to them. But you go to a leisure centre and that's people's leisure time. And if it looks a bit fun and the kids get a balloon, they're really happy to sit down and tell you about their experiences.
So what kind of content did you capture from that?
So we had a massive uplift on social media just from that week because we were sharing what people were willing to tell us on social media channels. We had a lot more hits on the website than we ordinarily would. We had phone calls come into our information and signposting team. We recruited some volunteers from that. We currently have cancer and maternity patient partners who are people who have experienced those services in the last 5 years. And we met some people who happened to just be at the leisure centre that day. They'd had cancer in the last few years. They'd had a particular experience they wanted to share. And we offered them the opportunity and they came on board. So so there were lots of things, really. It can sometimes, that's the other thing, it can sometimes be quite difficult to draw everything together tangibly and prove impact. And yet we know that it's there. They're the measurable things, but then there are all the intangibles. There are a whole lot of people who now know about us who didn't.
So were you, what were you capturing? Were you capturing video, text, photos, all of the above?
We were capturing mainly video because we were getting people to sit on the bed and talk to us. But if people weren't comfortable with that, then we would sit and we'd take their story just in the written form. And if they were willing to have a photograph taken, then we would do that. And it was interesting because it kind of helped. There were a few trends. I mean, one of the trends was definitely mental health and people not really knowing where to go about mental health problems. Where would they go and what would they do? And there was also an issue around information and where do they find information generally about all sorts of different conditions. Sometimes there was something about GP access, so not being able to get into their GP when they needed to, which is a very common theme. So there were themes that came up, but there was also a massive amount of variety from which it would have been very difficult to draw any conclusions if you were looking for themes. Everybody has different issues with health and social care depending on their circumstances. So in some ways it was quite nice to show just how broad some of these stories are. You know, they cover all sorts of different aspects of health and social care.
And that content, were you mainly sharing it across social media, or so was it on social media and then you were sharing YouTube videos, or just directly to Twitter or Facebook, or what?
We did a little bit directly to Twitter as and when we were out and about. Most of those were not videos though, because we had a professional videographer with us, so he took time to edit it and send it back to us. In the end, we put together a bit of a collage of the whole week, and then used that on social media, and that was quite successful because it was a nice little snapshot of what it is that we do.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite good as well, is to, when you do these things, very often the content has multiple uses. Yep. So you can come back to it and use it in other forms.
Yep,
so,
definitely.
Because that can sometimes be a sticking point when you come up with a cost and put it to the board about whether we spend this money on this particular initiative. And you can't predict what the outcome is going to be entirely. You can hope for particular performance indicators to be met, but you can't know for certain. And so knowing that you're going to have a whole load of content at the end of it, which can continually be pumped out on channels to help you promote what it is that you do, is a definite outcome from a week like that. Yeah. So, and it's on our website as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, stuff. And do you sort of, are you continuing to share that? Do you share sort of alternative edits of the sort of snippets that you captured and all that sort of stuff? And are you also sharing that on Instagram as well now?
We haven't shared it on Instagram yet, so we could go back and review that because we hadn't fully set it up at that time. But I think we have edited some of the pieces and put them back out again.
Yeah.
So we're kind of using them in different ways.
Obviously, we are a video production company, so we sort of we are sort of big on people utilizing video. And one of the things that we find is that people have these videos produced, but then they don't share them as frequently as they should.
Yeah.
And it is literally about sharing it over and over and over and over and over and over.
It comes back to return of investment. You need to get your return of investment out.
Because you might hit an audience one day, but then the next day you might see nothing. And then the next day you see 2,000 people all of a sudden have watched your video. And it really makes such a huge difference to share it and share it across different platforms as well.
Yeah. We might be a bit guilty of that, of kind of moving on to the next thing, because then there's another initiative and we're moving on to that. The one thing that we do though, particularly with something like that, is that we've edited them into different topic areas, because people, you know, when you ask them what's your biggest concern about health and social care, people will talk about the thing that's most at the forefront of their mind right now. Mm-hmm. One lady, for example, said, you know, I'm really concerned about how much wastage there is in medication, because I was in the pharmacy and I saw somebody bring in a whole load of bags. And when I spoke to the pharmacist later, she was saying that's literally thousands and thousands of pounds worth of stuff that I just have to throw out because it's left the pharmacy. And that happened to coincide with an initiative that was being run by one of the clinical commissioning groups in the area.
Yeah.
To get people to look in the bags before they leave the pharmacy in case you've got medication that you don't need anymore.
Yeah.
Don't be stockpiling tons of it in your house.
Yeah.
So we gave that footage to them because it gives it another outing. So again, don't think we tend to believe in working with partners so that it gets the most exposure rather than rigidly just clinging onto it as our stuff,
Definitely.
So we've done that quite a few times where a topic has been raised and then a campaign's being run by someone else and we see an opportunity, then we give them what we've got so that it gets a fair writing.
It's what we're always saying is share, share and share again. It doesn't matter where, as long as it is shared.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, the reason why you're producing that video isn't necessarily just to have a video, it's to share people's stories and people's experiences, and that's what's most powerful. Doesn't matter where it comes from, what channel it's shared on, as long as you're getting that message out there, that is what is important.
That's it. Absolutely.
So which of those methods will you continue to use, and are you considering utilizing any others? I mean, you've mentioned that you're sort of dabbling in Instagram now to sort of target that younger audience. Are there any other methods and techniques and pathways that you're going to utilize in the future?
So one actually just came up yesterday, which was someone was talking about when they'd done a bit of research that most of the kids that they find they were talking to people about gangs and involvement in gangs. And they were saying most of the children that they spoke to were on Snapchat, and that was how they got a lot of their information. Mm-hmm. And I use Snapchat for the ridiculous filters and things, but I don't really use it probably in the way that it could be used to communicate with other audiences. Yep. So that's another one we might look at. The one thing that I'm always concerned to make sure is that we don't, because we still only have a small resource available to us, and you can end up spreading yourself too thin across too many channels.
Yeah, that is something that we see quite a lot, is that people think, right, got to have a Twitter, got to have a Facebook, got to have an Instagram, got to have a LinkedIn, got to have a website, got to have a YouTube, got to have Snapchat,
exactly.
got to have all of this. But actually the reality is you've got to focus on where your audience are.
Exactly.
And if you're finding that your audience are on Snapchat, use Snapchat. If you're finding that they're on Instagram, use Instagram, but don't necessarily use all of them all at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because once you've got a channel, people tend to think that you're committed to it and you have to keep it. Yep. But actually, if your audience moves away from that channel and moves somewhere else, then you move with them. And if you can't devote the time to keeping that channel open and it doesn't provide enough of a return on investment, then you should be brave enough to close it and explain to your board why you're doing it rather than cling on to it rigidly because it happened to be something you once had.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we'd all still have our, what was it? They used to have Bebo accounts and MySpace.
Bebo, it's
the beginning, isn't it? Bloody hell.
Yeah, MySpace. I had a Bebo account. You'd be glad to know it's all been reset. You can't find any of the profiles or pictures.
It used to be when you Googled my name, the very first picture that came up was the one from my Bebo profile.
Don't worry, they're all gone.
That is the best news you could have given me today. I haven't Googled my name in a long time.
Brilliant.
So, and we'll continue to look at new and innovative ways to engage with people face to face because, you know, that Baird Roadshow was really great fun and it did serve a purpose. And there are things we learned from it that I think we could put into practice in another form of face to face event. But we don't know what that is yet. We're kind of still batting around a few ideas.
I'm going to be really awkward and ask the opposite now. What marketing methods wouldn't you use in the future? What hasn't worked so well for you? Or what do you think maybe you could do better next time?
So we get absolutely hounded by people trying to sell advertising space. I take so many calls every week. Where there's been a particular initiative where something might link. So we've just done a big piece on mental health awareness and we want to promote our telephone line number and we think that this particular magazine will be the right audience for it, then we might do it. But I'd say might because I've never seen an enormous return on any of those adverts that we've done.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised that there are people out there who, when confronted with an unsolicited call from any publication, and I understand they've got their sales team and they have to make their money to fund them, but would just say yes, that sounds like a good idea without any thought as to how it fits into any strategy or any way in which it would connect. So I am increasingly moving away from that altogether as a mechanism. I think you have to be prepared to be flexible though, because to rule out any mechanism I think would be a bit foolhardy. There's always going to be a value in something somewhere
for some part of your, and especially because your audience is so broad.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's always going to be someone that will pick it up and go, oh yeah, that's useful, I'll get in touch with Health
exactly
Watch. Yeah.
And we monitor whether what we do is successful. So at one point we put our details on the back of appointments cards in hospitals.
Okay.
Now, one would think that's a pretty good place to place it because if you're having difficulty accessing what you need and you're sat there and you always have your appointment card in your hand, don't you, waiting to go in and there's not much else to read. And we didn't receive a single call from that initiative because we do ask, So that's not one that I, and then I was contacted by them, would you like to do it again? You just can't justify carrying on with expenditure like that because it isn't working for you. And sometimes you never really know why,
and that's the problem, isn't it? It's a balance of budget sometimes as well, isn't it? Even if you maybe got one or two people out of that, you may go, oh, it still doesn't quite fit into what we're paying out for.
Exactly.
That.
Yeah. It's always a weighing up, isn't it? Is this a good use of our money? And is it having the return that we want it to?
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining us and talking about marketing and comms. Yeah, exactly. So where can we find Healthwatch Essex and yourself online?
So we're at healthwatchessex.org.uk and you can, when you go on there, you'll be able to see a link that takes you to all of the contact details for it. It's called Speak to Our Team and it's got all of our, because we've got a telephone number for the office and then we've got a telephone number for the information team.
Of course.
and we've got a WhatsApp number for them and various different mechanisms to get hold of us and email addresses. So to list them all now would be very difficult, but they're all on there. And on our Twitter, and our Twitter account is probably one of the most well used.
Okay.
So
what's your handle?
HW Essex.
Wonderful.
That's a nice handle.
Yeah. So thank you so very much for joining us.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Thank you so much to Rachel for spending a good hour speaking to us, really giving us the ins and outs of her career, her experiences, and now what she's doing at Healthwatch Essex to really bring charity comms into the 21st century. If you enjoyed this episode, we reckon that you might like some of our previous episodes. You can listen to them all on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and of course, Anchor. You can also go to our website at 2cube.co/TFTC, where you can listen back to all the previous episodes. If you want to come onto our podcast or send us a message, you can do so by emailing us at hello@2cube.co or by sending us a tweet to @2cubedcreate. And with that, we shall see you, speak to you on the next episode of 2 from 2 Cubed.